Well, thanks very much, Peter, and it's very nice to see you this Thursday afternoon. Thomas Jefferson was one of the early presidents of the United States. He was the founder of the American Democratic Party. He was one of the authors of the famous American Declaration of Independence, and the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, if you go there, there is a leather-bound book on display there called Jefferson's Bible. And what Thomas Jefferson did was he went through the Bible, went through the New Testament part of the Bible, and he cut out with scissors all the bits that mention miracles. And then the remaining bits he pasted into an exercise book. So this is actually a photo of Jefferson's Bible. If you squint, if you go and look carefully afterwards, we put the same printout on the front of the sheet there, you'll actually see that there's pasted out bits stuck down on that. And if you were reading through Matthew's account of Jesus' life, you'd see Matthew chapter 5, Matthew chapter 6, Matthew chapter 7, the Sermon on the Mount, and Jesus making that amazing address, the Sermon on the Mount. But you get to chapter 8 of Matthew's account of Jesus' life, the chapter that we're going to be looking at now, and Thomas Jefferson had cut it out of his Bible. He snipped it out. There's no chapter 8 in Jefferson's Bible. And Jefferson had the view that I don't believe in miracles. Miracles don't happen. I couldn't accept that Jesus could do a miracle. When Jesus walked on water, it was really a sandbank. People don't get healed. People don't rise from the dead. That's what Thomas Jefferson would have said. And if I was giving this talk 20 years ago, I'd have actually had to spend a fair bit of the time that we've got allocated over lunchtime today interacting with the Thomas Jeffersons in the audience, in that people would be very sceptical about the miraculous. But things have actually changed. Our thinking as a community has changed. Our society has changed. And much, much more now we're prepared to say, yeah, that stuff happens. Our question today is not so much, does the supernatural happen? But the question today is, well, I live in the third millennia. You say Jesus did miracles 2,000 years ago. What's that got to do with me as I go back to the office 2 o'clock this afternoon? And what I want us to do is, these first couple of weeks of City Bible Forum, is we're actually going to look at Jesus as he's out meeting people, talking with people, interacting with people, and doing miracles. And we're actually going to see him there. He's just finished the Sermon on the Mount. We saw amazing authority displayed by Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount. In fact, if you look at Matthew chapter 7, verse 28, the last sentence in the Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds who were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority, not as their teachers of the law. As Jesus spoke, there's no footnotes in his address. He spoke with authority. He spoke with the authority of God. And now what happens is Jesus goes out to do the miracles, and he puts his money where his mouth is. For three chapters, Jesus has talked the talk, and now he's walking the walk, and we're going to see extraordinary authority from Jesus these next 20 minutes, and we're going to look at the four examples of him exercising authority. We're going to then look at some implications from us, and then we're going to play really what I would describe as one-day cricket question time, in that the difference between what we normally would do in question time of people asking questions is that I'd get time to think about the question while you said it, but in this new structure of one-day cricket question time, they just give them to me and I get no time to think about them, and I call them one-day cricket because it just means you hit lots of shots and you do it very fast, but the accuracy suffers. But we'll have a go at that at the end of the talk today. So here we go. Chapter 8, and Jesus demonstrating authority. First incident, Jesus demonstrates his authority over leprosy. Sentence 1, he came down the mountainside and large crowds followed him. A man with leprosy came and knelt before him and said, "Lord, if you're willing, you can make me clean." Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. "I am willing," he said, "be clean." And immediately he was cured of his leprosy. Then Jesus said to him, "See that you don't tell anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer the gift Moses commanded as a testimony to them." Now Jesus knew the social stigma of leprosy. Early part of the Bible, right at the beginning of the Bible, in a book called Leviticus, there were laws set down in this book, and they said that a leper must live outside of town, must keep 2 metres from anyone else, and about as close as you and I are, is about as close as you could go to a leper. I don't know about you, but I've never met a leper. And from what I've read, though, a leper doesn't feel any pain. in that leprosy has deadened the nerve cells. A person with leprosy could walk all day on a sharp metal screw pressed into their foot. Or a person with leprosy, if they got an infected eyeball, they could scratch it and they wouldn't feel it. In fact, all the pain that a leper feels doesn't come from internal physical pain, but comes from being ostracized by the wider community. I read of a Western doctor treating a man with leprosy in India. And as she's speaking with this patient, she explained the treatment that she was going to give him, and she actually put her arm around his shoulder and squeezed it. And this Indian leper began to cry. And the Western doctor, concerned, said, "Oh, have I hurt you? Have I said something wrong?" And the reply came back through the translator, "No. No, he's crying because you put your hand on his shoulder. And until you came, no one has touched him for years." Even yesterday at the City Bible Forum, we had a bloke walk in, and it happens all the time in the City Bible Forum, mostly business people here, mostly people heading back to work, but one of the homeless guys came in, and he walked in here and sat down, and over lunch, as sandwiches are served and we're looking after him, he explained his philosophy of life, and he explained that he didn't believe in washing, and the great enemy in life was soap, that he hadn't had a shower or a bath, he hadn't washed for 2 years, he hadn't been in the water for a swim for 20 years. And talking with him, Peter was talking with him and shook his hand as we're finishing up and leaving. And it was clear that this man is not used to being touched. Anyway, Jesus touches the man. See, look, verse 2. The bloke says, "If you're willing, you can make me clean." Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. "I am willing, be clean." By touching the leper, by all rights, Jesus should have become ceremonially unclean, ceremonially defiled. But what's happened? Jesus has demonstrated his authority. Jesus doesn't become unclean. Rather, Jesus makes the unclean man clean. Now, that's the first incident. Second one. Again, Jesus demonstrating authority, and this time the person at the centre of the action is not a Jewish outcast, a leper, but it's somebody even further away from God, somebody who is racially a non-Jew, someone who's right outside the Old Covenant people of God. And Jesus here demonstrates again his authority, healing the servant of the Gentile centurion. Centurion is a Roman soldier. Soldier sent a meter. 100 centimetres in a metre, centurion, 100 soldiers under a centurion. So he's fairly high up in management in the Roman Empire. And Matthew 8, sentence 5, when Jesus entered Capernaum, centurion came to him asking for help. "Lord," he said, "my servant lies at home paralysed and in terrible suffering." And again, Jesus' response is shocking. See 7, Jesus said to him, "I'll go and heal him." I don't think that you and I feel the shock here that it's shocking because a Jew is speaking to a Gentile. Jesus is a Jew, the bloke is a Gentile. Secondly, it's Jesus saying, "I'll go to the house of a Gentile." And thirdly, particularly given what's already happened, you can be fairly sure that when Jesus gets to the house, he's planning to touch him. Even the centurion is shocked. See what he says, 8. The centurion replied, "Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed." That's astonishing, because the centurion is saying, "I understand authority." He's a military man. He gives a military metaphor, and he understands the way authority works. He understands when the centurion speaks, he's speaking with the very authority of the Roman emperor. So if the centurion is speaking, if the centurion tells a foot soldier to do something, then actually the Roman emperor is telling the foot soldier to do something. And Jesus, when the centurion hears Jesus speak, he's clicking on to Jesus is acting with the authority of God. And if Jesus is representing God, then I'm not worthy to have you come into my house. And so 10, when Jesus heard this, he was astonished and said to those following him, "I tell you the truth, I've not found anyone in Israel with such great faith." The centurion's faith is especially amazing because the centurion, being a Gentile, doesn't even have the Old Testament, early parts of the Bible to help him understand. But this Gentile centurion has penetrated, has understood even more deeply the nature of who Jesus is than anyone else in Israel at that time. Thirdly, another demonstration of Jesus' authority. And this time it's a woman. And it's Peter's mother-in-law. We won't make a big deal of this afternoon, but Peter was the first pope and he had a mother-in-law, which probably means he had a wife, because it's not normal for a bloke to have a mother-in-law without having a wife. I'm not making a big deal of that. It's just one for you to ponder. Then 14, Jesus came into Peter's house. He saw Peter's mother-in-law lying in bed with a fever. He touched her hand and the fever left her, and she got up and began to wait on him. Again, it's Jesus touches the sick person. Again, that's something forbidden by Old Testament law. And again, the healing touch doesn't defile the healer, but heals the defiled. I think, though, the point to be made here is that this healing is instantaneous. It's complete. And then the moment she's up, looking after, serving Jesus. And then the fourth incident, it's Jesus displaying authority in the lives of many. See 16. When evening came, many who were demon-possessed were brought to him. He drove out the spirits with a word and healed all the sick. Now, I'm just going to give a little analysis in terms of understanding Jesus' authority. You might like to jot down a question, and then in a moment we'll call on somebody to go nip round and pick them up. But what Jesus has done is exercise his authority in action in healings. Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 through to 7, he talked the talk. Now here we go in chapter 8 of Matthew's account of Jesus' life, and he's walking the walk. He's demonstrating an authority that is complete, that is instantaneous. Why does he do it? Why does he do these four things that have so embarrassed Thomas Jefferson, so embarrassed millions of Enlightenment modernist Christians? The answer comes in 17. This was to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. He took up our infirmities and carried our diseases. Now, you read that, say, okay, Isaiah, 800 BC, predicted that somebody would come who would take up our infirmities and carry our diseases. And you could just take that face value as saying Isaiah said Jesus would heal, and so Jesus did heal. But flick, it's coming up on the screen, Isaiah, but just as we go to it, little background. When God created the world, God made the world, he made a world that was good, a perfect world, with no sickness, with no pain, with no sin, with no evil. And then people rejected God, they defied him, they committed autonomy, and sin came into the world. And God starts to move to undo the effects of evil, to undo the effects of sin. And Isaiah is pointing to the day when God would fully and finally counteract the effects of sin in the world. And so Isaiah chapter 53, 800 BC, is one of the great Old Testament predictions of the coming of Jesus, the death of Jesus. And so you go back there to Isaiah 53 and sentence 3, you read there, he was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering, like one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised. We esteemed him not. And then the quote that we looked at a moment ago from Matthew's account of Jesus' life, surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows. And yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him. And by his wounds we were healed. Now, if you've seen Handel's Messiah, you'll know that Handel interprets that passage as pointing to the cross of Christ, to the death of Christ. And yet here in sentence 17 of Matthew's account of Jesus' life, Jesus interprets this passage as being fulfilled that day when he was doing those healings. So I'm faced with the question, has Handel got it wrong or has Jesus got it wrong? But then he's saying, well, hang on, it wasn't just Handel. It's 2,000 years of church history. They've seen Isaiah as pointing to the death of Christ. And when you look at it in context, it looks like he's pointing. Didn't Jesus know what was going on? Here's the key. In his death, Jesus was crushed for our iniquities. In his death, Jesus does buy the punishment that brings us peace. In his death, Jesus is able to achieve peace with God for us, so that anyone who trusts Jesus, they can look forward to a day when the blind would see, when the lame would walk, when the lepers would be cleansed, when the deaf would hear, when the bleeding would stop, where they can look forward to heaven. And what you see in Matthew 8, as Jesus walks into the life of Peter's mother-in-law and heals her, as Jesus walks into the life of the centurion's slave and heals him, you see Jesus giving a little foretaste, a little preview, a sneak preview, a little glimpse of what he's going to achieve in the big picture in his death and what is going to be achieved spectacularly at heaven. And you ask, well, did these healings make any difference? I'm going to say, on the big picture, no. I mean, millions still die of heart disease. Millions still die of cancer. Hospital operation wards are flat out. My mother-in-law is in hospital for three hours yesterday. No, these healings didn't make any difference on the big picture. But yes, they made a major difference if you were Peter's mother-in-law. If you were the slave who worked for the centurion, that changed everything. And so I think we're to see that this, in this quote from Isaiah that Jesus picks up in Matthew, is that the healing miracles of Jesus point beyond themselves to his death and beyond that to heaven, to a place where healing will be a permanent feature. Now, if somebody wanted to go and collect those questions, I'll give you my conclusion and then we'll play about the questions. Conclusion. What are we to do, city workers, confronted with such an authority figure? Well, the right way to respond to any authority over us is to obey him. And the implicit issue of obedience that Jesus is looking for is following. A couple of ways you could follow. Too fast or too slow. The first one in 19, here's a bloke who's like a work experience person in your office. He's just too fast. 19, a teacher of the law came to him and said, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." Jesus replied, "Foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." And so it is like the work experience kid who kind of runs into the office and you're sitting down trying to work out a spreadsheet and some numbers, and this kid says, "I'll fix it." And there's no way you're going to let it. He's just too enthusiastic. He hasn't understood what the implications are. What the Lord Jesus is after is followers who are genuine, who know what it's going to cost. And I would charge today that nothing has done more harm to Christianity than the filling of the ranks of Christ's army with any and every volunteer who wants to come to Christ on their terms. City Bible Forum in a couple of months' time, as part of the Thursday night City Bible Extra course, there's going to be a series on that Thursday night called Introducing God. And one of the strengths of the Introducing God course is it actually gives people time to count that cost, to work out what it would look like in my life if I really was going to follow Jesus. But we need to see even today that Jesus is the authority of God on earth. He's the one who dies to usher in that new kingdom. He is the one worth following. But to follow Jesus will cost. It will cost in money. It will cost in time. It will cost in creative energy. And the question before us as we begin 2007 in the City Bible Forum is, are we seriously prepared to pay that cost? Are we prepared to count it and pay it? At a very base level, following Jesus means listening to him. You can't follow him if you don't hear him. And so it means prioritising time to listen. Don't be too fast to follow him. Second reaction, though, to Jesus is too slow. See there, 21? Another disciple said to him, "Lord, first let me go and bury my father." But Jesus told him, "Follow me. Let the dead bury their own dead." It's pretty confronting, isn't it? Because when you read that first, you think, well, actually, my dad died yesterday, the funeral's tomorrow, and he's saying leave now. I don't think you're supposed to read it like that. I think about the challenge from Jesus to follow me. And if I was to say, Lord, first let me go and bury my father. My father's 67. He's probably got another 20 years left in him. I'm actually saying, I want to put off getting serious about Jesus for another 20 years. But there's all sorts of things that you can say, first let me go and... I mean, I could say, Lord, I want to get serious about following you, but first I got my kids to grow up. When they've left home, when I'm an empty nester, then I'll start following you. Or a bloke I know standing for state parliament. He said, I'll get serious after the election. First let me go and... And Jesus says, no, that's too slow. You say, oh, I wouldn't do that. First, let me get through the financial year. Too slow, says Jesus. Well, question time. One day cricket question time. Are you going to throw them up? Are you going to bowl, Peter?
I could do that.
Well, why don't we try that? It's kind of Russian roulette question time.
Right. Start first with the spin ball.
Spin ball from Peter.
God made a world that was good. Healing makes good. So healing is the work of God. Would you agree?
God makes a world that is good. Healing makes good. So healing is the work of God. Yeah, absolutely, in my view. Every time somebody gets better, it's because God wills that person get better. And certainly that was true in the first century, and certainly I think that that is true today.
Do you believe that followers of Jesus today would have the same authority and power to perform such miracles?
Do I believe that the followers of Jesus today would have the same authority and power to perform such miracles? There will come to a sharper point on that question in 2 weeks' time when Jesus actually does say to his followers back then, you go and do it. And then we'll actually have to explore whether or not we have that power if you are a follower of Jesus. So I think I might take a... I want to have something to say in 2 weeks' time, so come back in 2 weeks' time.
And maybe a bit more time to think about the question.
Thanks for that little sly comment from gully.
In verse 4, why did Jesus tell the leper not to tell anyone about Jesus healing him?
In verse 4, why did Jesus tell the leper not to tell anyone about Jesus healing him? If you work through Matthew's account of Jesus' life, it's very interesting. At some points, Jesus says, go and tell, when he does something spectacular. And at some points, he says, shh. And so when you actually look at it very closely, you actually can realise that he's saying, go and tell in some geographic regions and shh in some other geographic regions. And when you look even more closely and you say, well, which geographic regions does he say what? He says, shh, in the Jewish regions, and he says, go tell in the non-Jewish regions, the Gentile regions. And I think it's because he doesn't want to bring things to a head just yet in the Jewish regions. He wants to actually wait till he's finished his preaching, and then he's actually going to bring things to a head, and they are going to actually really work out who he is, why he's here, and then they're going to kill him. But it's because he's got a timetable that he's working to.
Verse 17.
But do the reading. Have a read through Matthew and just see if that thesis bears out. Yeah.
Okay, so verse 17, does Jesus still carry our diseases?
I think rightly understood, the passage in Isaiah is talking about carrying our wrongs. And when it uses the term diseases, it's the consequences of me doing wrong, or there being wrong in the world, is sickness. And so, yeah, Jesus carries the disease in that he carries the punishment for sin. And so, yeah, my life is littered with wrong. And in the end, Jesus takes the blame for it. Yeah.
This is the last question. What was so great about the centurion's faith?
What was so great about the centurion's faith? The amazing thing, I think, about the centurion faith is that so early in this account of Jesus' life, because we're in chapter 8, and really all that's happened so far is Jesus was born, he grew up, he gave one speech, and now it's today. And this bloke's saying, "You're from God." And he's saying it without having done any of the background reading. That's very impressive. I mean, and I don't know where you're at today as you come to City Bible Forum today. Some people might have done lots and lots and lots of background reading. And you say, "Oh, okay, that all makes sense. I've read Isaiah. I've thought about that." And some people, it could just be your very first time hearing the Bible. And somebody's just said from your office, "Why don't you come along and check out Jesus as part of a New Year's resolution or something like that?" And even now, you could be having, "Oh, I don't like him," or, "I want to check out more." And if you're having that reaction, Jesus is actually saying, that's faith, that's good faith, that's trusting me, that's a commitment to me. And I'd encourage you to talk to Peter, talk to one of the other City Bible Forum team who are sitting around over sandwiches in a moment. Thank you for listening to me, and I shall look forward to being back here for Matthew chapter 9, the next instalment in this life of Jesus, getting down to business with Jesus in the city, next Thursday at 1:00.